In the first part of my conversation with Jane Quinn, we looked at the difference between simply having programs and partners in a school and organizing them to work together to address strengths and needs of students and families. The next question is, what must happen for that collaboration to become real in the day-to-day work of a school? Because even when the right people are present, collaboration does not happen automatically. People can share a building, attend the same meetings, and describe themselves as partners while still working largely in their own lanes. I sometimes describe that as parallel play. So, in this part of the conversation, Jane and I look at what must happen for parallel play to become shared work. Some of that is structural. Who is at the table? How is information shared? How decisions are made? And whether families and young people have a meaningful role in those decisions. But Jane also points to something different. She describes a shift that occurs when community partners stop thinking of academic success as primarily the school's responsibility and to say, in effect, we own the results with you. That changes the meaning of partnership. It means that when something is not working, people do not simply retreat to their own program, profession, or organization. They ask, what are we seeing? What are we missing? And what do we need to change? So this part is about moving from coordination to shared responsibility, from people working alongside each other to people doing the work together and holding themselves individually and collectively accountable for results. When you and I first met, I think when you and I first met, I was also working at Pam Cantor. And one of the things that Pam Cantor, as a physician, says is when a doctor is looking at you, they don't just take your blood pressure and make a decision.
Right.
Other pieces. And just as you need all the ingredients to bake a cake, you also need, if we're going to support the child's thriving and to enable that young person to succeed, you need to address that child in their wholeness.
Yeah, there are several publications in our field that start out whole child, whole school, whole community, really talking about the comprehensive nature of the strategy. And but really starting with the whole child and making sure that we are paying attention to all the domains of development that support each other. And we certainly learned a lot about that through the efforts of the science of learning and development, which has been taken to heart by the community schools field just as a very useful framework and useful tool.
In my conversations with Kwesi Rollins, who you work with a great deal,
Yes, yeah.
and Ray Saldana from Communities in Schools, they both spoke powerfully about the difference between listening to young people and families,
Yes.
sharing power with them meaningfully, something I
Yes.
know you are very concerned with as well.
Yeah.
What role should the active voice of young people and families play in the community school, and what does that look like?
Yeah. I think community schools really represent democracy in action. We are insistent that families, especially, but also students, should be part of the school leadership team or whatever that structure is that manages the governance and the planning and oversight of what's going on in the school. And it isn't just about listening, it is about authentic decision making. So that's an essential part of being a community school. And there may be other structures as well in the school, but it is essential to operationalize the school leadership team, whatever it's called, to include the ideas and the decision making of parents, other stakeholders, and age appropriately, probably not in elementary schools, but in an age appropriate way involving students.
When that is done, how does that not just enhance the feeling and trust level of parents and young people, but how does that contribute to the quality of the work that is going on in the community school?
Yeah, I think it is one of several ways to improve the quality at the school. Another way that we haven't talked about, but I really feel very strongly about this, is that, and I'm going to speak from Children's Aid's perspective, but there are lots of other organizations that do this too. Children's Aid sees an economic development agenda in community schools and is very careful to hire people from the local community, people who are of the same ethnic and cultural background as the students and families at the school. So we had a practice of hiring all of our parent coordinators came from the community. Most of our after school staff came from the community and looked like the kids and could be role models for the students because they were college students who had grown up in the same community. So these things, again, these ingredients interact with each other, right? So if you have a staff that is made up in good part from people from the community, they're going to hold you responsible for giving back to the community and for responding to the strengths and the needs of the community. That is really important. I have to say, we were all so excited when Joel Klein and Mayor Bloomberg said they were going to hire a parent coordinator for each school in New York City. We were like, oh, praise the Lord. But they didn't, and we told them what to do. We said, we have this model. It's important to hire from the community. And they did not do that. It was a law, it was another lost opportunity.
No, I think that's a powerful example of why in that evolution that you described before, you have to keep on moving. You can't just settle with doing something because it may look correct on paper. It's a family coordinator.
Right.
There are the essential elements of what makes a family coordinator powerful. And what you're also describing is something that has a deep foundation in thinking in the 60s, among others, regarding the role of people from the community. That's it, that informed the notions of early Head Start. And
Absolutely.
it was that economic development model. But as you say, it's also a political model, right? When
Right.
you have people from the community, and if they have a voice, they're going to help you be more responsive to the community.
That's right.
So let's go back to something we've talked about a little before, and that is, I'll use the word we didn't use, but silos, okay? There's a difference between a full service school where you have services that are co-located,
Right.
or a school, maybe it even says it's a community school, where what's really going on is a set of parallel play where people are
Yes.
doing this stuff themselves, even if they come together and say we are one team. What are the forms of trust, information sharing, joint problem solving that are necessary to make the school real in terms of being a coherent community school?
Yeah. In addition to, there's the spirit and then there's the structure, right? And I'm going to talk about them, but not necessarily in that order. So, most community schools have a school leadership team, but they also have something in Evansville, they call it the big table. They might call it a partners round table. There's a structure, and it can be at the building level or at the city level. In Evansville, the big table is at the city level, but it matches what happens at the building level, which is that the community school director and I don't feel like we've talked about that enough, an essential part of the community school. The community school director convenes a partners roundtable. That's a name for it, but the function of it is to make sure that the partners are coordinating their work with one another, making sure that what's being coordinated ratchets up to something comprehensive or at least responsive to the needs and assets assessment. And that is a regular table where people can look at data together and share what they're doing, but making sure that they are thinking together about whether they're responding to the strengths and needs of the students and families. That's how you avoid duplication. It's how you identify gaps, and it's how you move along the stages of development toward ex your word and mine as well, excellence. Another thing that's important is thinking about how do we make sure that we're getting the right supports and services to the right kids at the right time, right? Typically, people will let families sign up for after-school programs on a first-come, first-served basis. And that looks like democracy in action, but it may not be. So the field, I think, has made some great strides in addressing that set of issues about addressing equity as we address excellence.
Jane, one of the ways that one can mitigate silos and maybe even eliminate them is through continuous improvement if it is a value-driven collective enterprise that has the right people at the table and who use the data in the right way. What does that look like when it's working in a community school?
I'm very familiar with this issue as somebody who was on the staff of Children's Aid for 18 years. And I think we struggled to understand our role in promoting students' academic achievement. And I think at a certain point, we began to own that. And I think that's when we really started collaborating in a meaningful way. By working with our school partners to say, we own this. We are one team. We own this with you. And we want to contribute through all the things that we're doing. We're removing barriers to students' learning. We're expanding their learning opportunities through our after-school programs, our summer camps, our holiday programs. And that was a revelation to us, I think, that we were not only saying we're going to keep kids healthy, we're also going to contribute, we will own the results with you. And in some ways, that's scary for principals, and for many of them, it's a huge relief, a huge relief. So I think that has been, as I look at the field and the changes over the field in the 30 years that I've been involved in it, I think that represents a major change. And that is collaboration at its best, where you're thinking things through together, you're making collaborative decisions, and you're owning the results.
That word ownership here, which is not possessing, but a responsibility, is so essential, I think, so that it is that it's not just that the challenge in schools is how we serve what Lisa Delpert once called other people's children, but it's also how we respond to issues so that we see the challenges as well as the successes are ones that we have a responsibility for and we can do something about. One of the things that sometimes plagues schools and also the human services is the feeling of well-intended people that they can't make a difference, that they're not empowered to make a difference. How does a community school, when it is developing in a powerful way, enable people to feel empowered to collaborate and to make a difference?
I think the community school's strategy attracts people who are optimists. I have long said there are no cynics working in community schools. So I think that the strategy itself speaks to common sense, right? People hear about it, and when they understand it, they're like, yeah, why isn't every school like that? So, I think on the face of it, the community school strategy speaks to what most people know about human development, that we're not born in silos, that we are whole people. And I think that it attracts people who want to be problem solvers and who don't need all the credit, right? It attracts people who understand that the middle of the word collaboration is the word labor, right? That it's work and it's a way of working. So I don't know if that addresses what you're thinking about, but it speaks to me.
I think reminding people about how labor is in the word collaboration, and I would just add, co is also in together we are doing this work.
And David, I think it is not trivial that we have more and more evidence that when you work in this comprehensive, integrated, and collaborative way, you get better results. We didn't have that data 20 years ago. We don't have all we want, but I think the RAND study in New York is a bit of the Perry Preschool Study. I think it's a landmark study. I think what the Learning Policy Institute did in collaboration with the National Education Policy Center, that study in 2017 shook the bones of community schools. And so I think we now have both common sense and evidence that this work is on the right track.
And I would add, we also have more evidence that goes back to your first visit to the school in Washington Heights, that when this is done well, happier children. And I suspect the following, and I'm going to ask you if this is the case or not, based on an observation a colleague of mine, Mary McGee Quinn, made when we were studying effective collaborations in the 1990s in three big districts. And she said to me, I see in all these districts, people are working harder, but at the same time, they're happier. Okay. And so I invite you to comment.
One of the earliest findings of the children's aid work in Washington Heights was that teacher attendance and retention improved in the community schools. And that made me happy that teachers were feeling relief, feeling the joy of having competent partners. And student happiness is certainly a big one. I love it that some districts, including San Francisco, have the word joy in their mission statement. Isn't that great? And I'm going to tell you one more story. So I mentioned Joy Dreyfus, who wrote the seminal book that got us all started on this. And in the year 2001, when Joy was still on this planet, she called me up and she said, I want to bring a visitor to IS-218. I said, sure. But I said, who is it? She said, he's the House Majority Leader. His name is Steny Hoyer. He's a member of the US Congress. I said, we'd be honored to have Steny Hoyer come visit us. So Joy and I met Stenny in the lobby of IS-218 that I talked about, where there's the health center and the parent resource center. And he was a wonderful visitor, and we made an exception for him. We let him go in classrooms. One of our guidelines as a partner in these in community schools is we don't disrupt the teaching and learning that's going on during the school day. But it's Steny Hoyer, right? So we take him around. He's so lovely and charming. And he talked to the teachers, he talked to the kids, he met the principal. An hour later, he went to the clinic, he saw everything. He sat down in the family room and put his hands on his knees and started talking with the families. After an hour, he said to me, "I get it. I get what you're doing. It's wonderful," he said, "but there's something I don't understand." I said, "What?" He said, "Why are you doing this in a middle class school?" And I knew we had him. So I said, "Mr. Hoyer, what makes you think this is a middle class school?" He said, "The children look healthy, they're well dressed, they're happy." And I said, "With all due respect, this is one of the lowest income schools in New York City, but that's what children look like when their needs are met." He went back to the US Congress and slipped $5 million into the federal budget. And that was the beginning of the federal full service community schools program.
Thank you for sharing that story. That really is powerful and important.
The
And
history is important.
there's a river.